Welcome to Political Point of View on Coast Access Radio 104.7 FM. In this program, we talk with politicians of all types, of all sorts, from local government through to central government, and including aspiring candidates. Sit back and enjoy.
Hello listeners, today is another day of a political point of view. Today's guest, Simon Court, ACT MP from Auckland. Now Simon, it wasn't in the questions that I sent through, but I've been interviewing a large number of candidates for local body elections, and without fail they are all vehemently opposed to the Three Water Scheme, and it appears that right around the country with local bodies it's exactly the same. So how does that gel with ACT?
What ACT has said, if there needs to be a reform in the way that infrastructure, Three Waters infrastructure, is managed, then it needs to stay with the local community. So while we've heard the case for reform, what the government's proposing work, it's a highly complex governance structure. Two boards of directors, one selected, 50 based on ethnicity, an insufficient number of seats around the table for local communities, local government. Standard & Poor's, the government's own financial advisor, has said that the deal will be highly leveraged and risky. Yet the government tells us it's going to be better for communities, it's going to cost less in the long term. Simply doesn't believe it. We've proposed something different. What works is actually allowing communities to come together as regions, form regional partnerships, establish their own water entity by region if that's what they want to do. That's what the mayors of the councils in Hawke's Bay would prefer to do, and that's where the Havelock North water quality issue arose. We said, look, we've got enough money, so have the mayors in Taranaki, to actually fix their Three Waters problems over time, allow for growth. But they want to do that with their own regional alliance. They can get the benefits of scale. They can get the benefits of borrowing money at reasonable rates at scale. And actually, they'll deliver services where the community needs them to. That's where they'll be growing in the future and where there are assets that are older and need replacing. We think that's a much better alternative. It doesn't come with all the division and all the upheaval the Three Waters reform is causing communities.
I get a feeling that one of the major problems with the whole setup is the influence of the Maori seat.
Well, you certainly see that within the Labor Party there is a very strong Māori caucus, and the local government minister, Nanaia Mahuta, must play a big role in that. Now, there was a case we Māori had rights and interests in fresh water, which is what the minister claimed in her paper to cabinet. That's the reason she's proposed that we need this very complex governance structure with two boards of directors, one 50-50 appointed by iwi. That was the case, we would expect the Waitangi Tribunal or the New Zealand courts to have actually found that was the case. But it appears that the advice that the minister presented to cabinet from Crown Law, she's actually not prepared to release publicly. And our contention is that that's not the case. In fact, I asked the minister directly, what rights and interests do iwi Māori have in Three Waters assets? He said none beyond that of a normal ratepayer. So look, we think we've blown that one out of the water. No justification for it. By the way, so many of the Apu Marae groups who've submitted to Parliament's Finance and Expenditure Committee, which is hearing submissions on the Three Waters Bill, they've said, look, if there's only going to be four or six seats at the table, it'll be the big corporate iwi employees get to have their way, whereas the marae, APU who actually have direct relationships with council's water services department, their roading department, the people who are regularly consulted on when things are happening in their community, they say their voice will be lost. And so there are many Māori groups who actually oppose these reforms because of the dilution of local voice.
Okay. Has there been any finality yet about moving Ports of Auckland northwards?
Look, moving Ports of Auckland is this strange thing that comes up every few years where rather than addressing the real issues, which is how do we make sure that our ports operate more efficiently, because ports are vital. They're a vital link in our supply chain for exporters, people who make things or grow things and want to sell them to customers overseas. That's where New Zealand gets most of its money from. And they're also a vital link in the supply chain, as was revealed during COVID-19 lockdowns, where the ports weren't able to operate capacity, and there was a significant risk that New Zealand would run out of important stuff that we need. But rather than try and solve that problem, making better rules and regulations around how ports could or should operate, the government is having another inquiry into whether Auckland port could be moved to the Manukau Harbour of all places. I lived on the Manukau Harbour for 15 years in a beautiful bush suburb called Titirangi. I regularly kayaked on that harbour. I've been out over the Manukau Bar a number of times. It's a very dangerous place for recreational boaties, and it's no place to consider bringing in large commercial vessels. And yet, rather than have a discussion around, well, what does the Port of Auckland need or what does any other port in New Zealand need to operate efficiently, we're having this tilting at windmills, again, this Don Quixote approach to should we move the Port of Auckland. And, Graham, I'll just give you one example about how to make ports operate efficiently. Imagine a Port of Auckland. When you arrive, when you leave the motorway as a truck and trailer driver with a couple of containers on board heading to the Port of Auckland, you come down this fantastic section of motorway in the urban environment called Grafton Gully, and then you go back onto 19th century streets that wind their way past historical buildings and take you down towards the port. You cross a railway line waiting at traffic lights. And then when you go to turn into the port, you have to give way to cyclists passing on the left-hand side of a truck. It's blind spot. It couldn't be more complex, less efficient, to get from a really good motorway network into the port. Now, imagine if instead of moving the port, we actually started focusing, people in government and in government agencies started focusing on, well, what could we do to make it more efficient? Maybe they need some dedicated road access, a dedicated rail into the port. It's a far practical conversation to have than moving a $50 billion port somewhere.
Well, one of the big problems, of course, is that the rail network and the roading network can't sustain the extra volume of traffic without major alteration. And if the port were to move north.
Look, Kiwi Rail is making a huge investment in their network right now. They are replacing old wooden bridges with modern concrete, reinforced concrete structures that will last 100 to 200 years. They've been working on their tunnels in places like the Kaimai Ranges in the Bay of Plenty to widen and reline those tunnels to make them suitable for much bigger containers on board. So all of those things are important to happen. But KiwiRail admits that even if they reach their target of doubling the freight ask carried by rail from 4% to 8% of the nation's freight, at the same time, overall freight ask is going to increase by 15%. So we're still going to need to invest in good quality roads for these heavy trucks. Look, imagine I replicate a whole lot of structures and infrastructure for the benefit of moving a port. There's no economic and social benefits to that whatsoever. The only people who would benefit really are property developers and those who might currently overlook the port from their nice homes. There is no reason to spend $50 billion of taxpayer money.
Well, clearly Manukau is definitely out because of the shifting nature of the bar at the entrance. It's It's a very dangerous area, and it doesn't stay the same. It constantly moves. Right, another Auckland Harbour crossing. Where would ACT put it, and what form would it take?
Well, as much as I would love to be in charge of a big project like putting another harbour crossing in, the ACT Party doesn't believe that politicians should be choosing where stuff gets built. In fact, our policy is the opposite. We say that these decisions should be left to an independent infrastructure commission and an infrastructure commissioning agency like they have in Canada, where politicians of all parties agreed some time ago that these decisions about what gets built where should be left to the experts. But imagine we do need a new harbour crossing to add capacity, give people options about how they travel. And currently the fantastic Northern Express busway, which takes people right up the Northern Motorway on the North Shore, nearing capacity. That busway was built in the early 2000s. It was pretty cost effective at the time. It involves fantastic, well-lit stations, secure, safe park-and-ride facilities, and a separate two-lane dedicated busway for buses to come and go. So, look, that kind of public transport system does need to be connected to the city in a more efficient way, and a tunnel or a second crossing would be the way to do that. Look, currently the early investigation for that has in fact been procured by NZTA, but it's been procured in an unusual way, Graham, because they've rolled up the procurement of the second harbour crossing with the design and business case of Auckland Light Rail. I have a funny feeling that if Auckland Light Rail doesn't go ahead, that team will still have a fantastic project to get on with, which will be the design and delivery of the second harbour crossing.
Okay, so would your money be on a tunnel or a bridge?
I think a tunnel is the way to go. I mean, we've seen Sydney, the way that they've used cross-harbour tunnels to connect different parts of the city that were previously very difficult to move around. And I would say that that would probably be the best option for Auckland. But again, the ACT Party and ACT politicians won't be announcing that kind of stuff. We'll leave that up to the experts.
Okay. Well, I thought you were an expert on infrastructure.
I've chosen a different career now, and that involves making sure that we ask people doing like infrastructure, the hard questions, and those agencies and those departments of government responsible for delivering these kind of projects. So I'm more in a governance, hopefully being a governance role rather than a project delivery role these days.
Come on, I could really see you getting your teeth into something like this. What's ACT's views on what should happen with country roads? They're in an abysmal state, particularly in Northland, and there's a heck of a problem in Marlborough where the local council is considering not replacing some of the roads that have been devastated.
Yeah, well, we've got two classes of roads. We've got the state highways and rural areas. And
what
the
do you mean, bad and atrocious?
Yeah, and then we've got the local roads, which are only part funded through road user charges and part funded by ratepayers, and those local roads are the ones administered, say, by Marlborough District Council or the Far North District Council. There's really two problems to solve there. One is, you know, what does local government do to raise enough money to actually pay, fix and maintain the things that it needs to deliver service to the local community? I mean, in Auckland, we've got a province called Rodney District, and that's part of the Auckland Super City. Well, the Rodney District has thousands of kilometres of rural roads, so 80% of the rural roads in the Auckland region, and, you know, some of those roads have been recorded as having 20 potholes in 20 metres. We've had local communities organise working bees to get a truckload of gravel delivered, and they've gone out there and done their own stop go and filled their own potholes. Now, look, if ratepayers and taxpayers are going to be paying through their fuel excise duties at the petrol pump and through road user charges to have an acceptable level of service, then it's up to central government, local government, to work out how to deliver that. Otherwise, we'll be asking a serious question. Why should we be paying all of these taxes when when only around 25% of the money collected from fuel taxes and RUCs is actually used to construct roads, and not much more than that to maintain them. The rest of it gets sloshed off to rail and projects like bike bridges and Auckland Light Rail. But you know, coming back to Marlborough and Northland, I mean, those roads have been devastated by flooding events. Those flooding events, while they might appear extreme, are certainly within the bounds of what roading designers should be allowing for. It appears that a lot of drainage is undersized, it's old, it's no longer fit for purpose. These things do need to be renewed and replaced, and potentially upgraded when they go to replace them. And then you've got these issues with slips. I mean, the Manawatu Gorge continued to slip. The governments have spent, various governments have spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to fix the Manawatu Gorge and stop it falling into the river. In the end, they gave up. They're building a separate new road, separate alignment. It may well be that when we're thinking about climate resilience and actually making sure communities can remain connected, you know, for growth, you know, for all of those social benefits that transport connections provide, we may actually have to consider abandoning some places and putting new connections in different places that are more resilient. There's no budget for that ground, and yet apparently there will be a budget to build Auckland Light Rail and Light Rail through Wellington. It doesn't seem fair, and it doesn't seem regions are getting a fair go at the moment.
Okay, one of the big problems, of course, is that as EVs become the norm rather than the exception, what's going to replace the petrol sales tax, the road tax, and most importantly, the GST? Like every time I fill up my car, I'm paying about $22 GST. What's going to replace that?
Yeah, well, this is one of the most important problems to solve. You know, how do we fund, finance the roading infrastructure that we need? There's one thing, I guess, that roads have that maybe other infrastructure doesn't have, and that's the ability to actually make the users of the service pay. At the moment, we have a really clunky system, which is collecting petrol tax at the pump. Clearly that doesn't cover EVs, or we collect road user charges from heavy and light diesel vehicles. And yet there's no way of actually measuring whether the road the truck uses or that the motorist uses is the one getting the money that they've paid through their road user charges. Now, there's much simpler ways to do this. You look at countries like Singapore, or the USA. I'm actually heading to the USA next week to look at infrastructure funding and financing and project delivery. What they've managed to do is use smart roads, smart meters essentially on the vehicles, so that people pay to use the roads they're actually using, and then that money goes back into maintaining and upgrading those roads. Now, that seems to be, in the future, the way we'll need to go. But rather than look at that as an urgent problem to solve, the current government is doing, under Transport Minister Michael Wood, is trying to work out how he's going to raise $30 billion from taxpayers to pay for his Auckland Light Rail. Because remember, Auckland Council said they're not paying for it. And again, the same issue with Let's Get Wellington Moving. Project, you know, with an $8 billion thumbsuck price tag on it. I mean, you'd say double that, because that's how these things go. And he's trying to work out how he's going to find the money to do that. Well, look, the entire land transport budget is about $4.5 billion a year. If they can't even fund that, then they've really got their priorities wrong.
I can imagine the popularity of a government that puts a tax on EVs after...
Well, Graham, I mean, they've put a tax on utes, a tax on vans, they've put a tax on people movers. I mean, that's what they call their clean car standard. And they're using some of that money and taxpayer money to subsidise very wealthy people, in the large part, to buy very expensive EVs, you know, Teslas up to $80,000. So I think there's going to be a reckoning. We're certainly hearing it from people that we meet as we go around, as ACT MPs go around New Zealand, that they think not only is this terribly unfair, it's just counterproductive. Those kind of policies aren't reducing emissions. They're not helping to fix congestion, which actually causes more carbon emissions the longer cars sit waiting in traffic. And of course, you're going to need thousands and thousands of megawatts, dozens of new power stations to power these EVs if that's what replaces our current vehicle fleet. Yet no regulatory environment to do that. For example, if you want to put an oil rig down in Taranaki off the coast and you've already got a permit, of which it is permitted to do, you could just ring up the government agency, MB, say, I'm going to put a new oil rig down. If I come and have a look at the site, they'll say, yeah, we'll be out there in 6 weeks' time. The paperwork, order the oil rig, you go. If you want to put a wind farm in coastal Taranaki, currently there's no regulatory pathway to do that. You can't apply for consent, you can't apply for permits, can't install it. So if we really even wanted to have EVs and to have them charged from renewable electricity, the government's not serious about doing any of that kind of stuff. But taxing utes to subsidise wealthy people to buy Teslas seems to be what they think is good policy.
Well, of course, utes are rather frequently used by farmers and tradies, and they don't really figure very much, I don't think, in the current government's thinking. What's your thoughts on farmland being converted to growing carbon credits with pine?
Certainly the case that some really good-looking sheep and beef country has been converted to growing pine forests. Was happening before carbon forestry or simply growing trees to store carbon became popular. I think we've got two problems to solve here. One is that excessive governments, national, who went to Paris and signed the Paris Climate Accord, and then Labour, Prime Minister declaring a climate emergency, James Shaw flying off to Glasgow and other conferences and making even more extreme commitments on behalf of New Zealand. He never got a mandate for, by the way. He went to Glasgow and announced that we would reduce our emissions by 50% in 2030. Didn't ask the New Zealand people whether they'd be prepared to pay for that. And in fact, the New Zealand Treasury and Ministry for Environment, his own advisors, said, please don't announce that. Please don't, because not only we not know how we could possibly deliver it, all you're doing is creating this massive financial and environmental risk for New Zealand. That cost is estimated, based on what James Shaw announced at Glasgow, it's going to cost New Zealand taxpayer $30 billion before the emissions cuts that James Shaw promised. Now, either we pay the money to, say, offshore schemes, or we plant New Zealand out in pines. But what ACT is that's crazy. What we should be doing is allow businesses to reduce their own emissions, either here in New Zealand or offshore, enter into private agreements to do that. And we've got these big consultancies who are going around the world certifying whether companies are meeting their environmental and social objectives, what they call ESG. These big six consultancies, we call them, Ernst & Young and PwC and Deloitte and all the others. There's no reason why those same organisations don't certify that New Zealand manufacturers, New Zealand businesses, offsetting their emissions overseas without the taxpayer on the hook. I've actually got a members' bill in the biscuit tin at Parliament which says just that. It's called the Climate Change Response Act Amendment. What my bill would allow companies to do is to say, look, if you're making stuff here in New Zealand, you're making steel, you're making paper, you're recycling glass like they do at OI Glass and Penrose in Auckland, you've got very high energy costs and that energy is from hydrocarbons, then because you're an international business, you should certainly be allowed to offset your emissions in another country you operate in. That's planting forests or whether that's sequestering carbon. I think that's a much cheaper way to do it, actually. future of really good, productive New Zealand farmland is only under pressure because of the three, four policy settings, outrageous commitment made by this government on behalf of New Zealanders.
The whole carbon trading system seemed to me to be terribly complex and very difficult to understand and implement.
Well, Graham, it does not appear that way, not because it is. Actually, it's quite simple. When you go and fill up, you mentioned GST on petrol before, if you go and fill up your car with petrol or diesel, pay about 20 cents a litre for your emissions under the emissions trading scheme. You're already paying for your emissions. Emissions trading scheme requires people who supply the fuel pay for the carbon produced when that fuel is made and used, and they pay for carbon credits under the ETS. It collects about $1.5 billion a year at the moment. It's expected to be $2.5, maybe $3 billion a year in time. What it says, look, if you're already paying for your emissions, you're a business owner, you're a householder, you're a tradie, rather than the government deciding to spend that money on crazy schemes, what could happen is you should get a carbon dividend. What they do in Canada, every Canadian, man, woman and child gets a carbon dividend from their emissions trading scheme every year. New Zealand Act believes that would be around $1,000 per household, around $250 per person. And household or individuals, flatties, use that to put towards a household bill, pay off a more energy efficient appliance like a heat pump, but that would be up to them. We think it would be the best way of reinforcing to New Zealanders a market-based system of paying for your emissions, making choices, sits with the individual rather than government and ministers who insist on announcing more and more wacky green schemes like paying $10,000 to people to crush cars under Mike Woods' Chipper scheme, $500 million buy old cars from people and hand them $10,000 of taxpayer money. Scheme actually is in design right now by MOT, Ministry of Transport, and we expect that to be rolled out in the next few months. ACT absolutely opposes a greenwash scheme.
There's a proposal to build a fairly extensive solar farm. Now, is that effective use of flat? It's got to be in an area of flat land in the country because of the space it takes up. So the assumption is that that's got to go onto farmland. Is this cost effective?
Graham, that people who own property should be able to do what they will, whatever they want with it, as long as the effects on the other people and the neighbours are appropriate. So, look, if a farmer or landowner wants to turn their land from sheep and beef or kiwi fruit into a solar panel farm, I think it'd be up to them if they think it's the most efficient way to use their land.
How effective are large solar panel farms?
You know, there's plenty of examples around the world where large solar arrays contribute a significant amount of energy. When the sun shines, Graham, but when the sun's not shining, they don't contribute any energy at all. So look, all of these things need to be evaluated by people who are standing up this kind of technology or want to undertake this kind of development. The issue is for New Zealand as a whole, going to bring more and more renewables to the energy mix, then we also need to provide either storage electricity when it's not being used, so we can use it, say, at night, or the gas-fired power stations always on standby so that on a cold, still night in winter, we can, when the sun doesn't shine and the wind turbines aren't spinning, we could turn on our gas power stations and we have that backup. And ACT thinks that that's probably the best way to go in terms of energy affordability and security of supply.
Well, that's not in the current government's thinking. They prefer to burn dirty Indonesian coal.
That's right.
Right, Simon, we've run out of time because you've got another appointment. very much appreciate your time. Thank you for listening. This has been Graham Priest with another session of A Political Point of View, and today's guest, Simon Court, ACT MP. Thank you very much. Really appreciate your time.
You have been listening to Political Point of View on Coast Access Radio 104.7 FM. In this program, we've talked with politicians of all types, of all sorts, from local government through to central government, and including aspiring candidates.
This program is made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.